Heavenly Father, we're just so grateful to gather, learn from your word, pray for this time together that you could open our hearts and remind us that you're always working all things for our good, and even in the waiting, give us the hope and peace that comes with knowing that you're working all things.
Thank you very much. Okay, so last week we concluded with, I think, an observation of the background that's challenging Saul. And we had quite a change. Or like we went into a different direction in chapter 8, first seven verse, or chapters of 1 Samuel were setting up chapter 8 where the people reject God and want a king. I mean, it's a horrible thing, but we're given some lead up to that. In chapter 18, we have quite a change in the life of Saul, which began in chapter 16 without him really appreciating the significance of it. The Spirit of God has departed from him due to repetitive disobedience and disregard and really disrespect of God even publicly. And the consequences of that are starting to take effect and are going to accelerate between now and the end of Saul's life. And the life of Saul, it's easy or it's tempting to look at Saul and saying, you know, wow, Saul, you really made some bad choices. And these bad choices are going to yield some really serious consequences. And in some not intentional way, but maybe inadvertent way, we kind of stand in judgment of Saul. In fact, we find it maybe too easy to find a way to stand in judgment of the people around us who are unbelievers, who don't understand, who are making decisions in their life that exclude God, that are self-serving. And yet, I think that the major message is not so much the kind of sad and pathetic illustration that we have of Saul, because it tells us of a man who has everything. A man who has a direct purpose that's known. He's the first king of Israel, that is God's own people. He was anointed by God, chosen by God. He's given a special relationship with the prophet of God, and yet he squanders or ignores or avoids anything really to do with the spiritual matters. And I think that the life of Saul is a bit of a, I don't know if it's a warning or just an illustration to us, of you can be that close to God, have that kind of access to God, be that blessed of God, and still neglect that relationship to such a degree that Saul continues to harden his heart and winds up in the most pitiful position of all at the end of this first Samuel. We've been blessed with untold blessings from God. God has intervened into our life. Saul never came to know God. And save but the grace of God, we would be just like Saul, and maybe even more aggressively selfish, self-serving. So it's not, Saul's example isn't for us to have like a punching bag or a tackling dummy. It's to really remind us of the blessings and the advantages that God has given each of us. And are we taking advantage of the access that God has given us to him like he gave to Saul? Saul ignores it. Saul neglects it. Saul doesn't pursue it. Saul's not interested in it. And yet God is on a silver platter handed us through the death of Christ, the redemption of us by Christ.
this incredible gift of having access to God, that all we have to do is intentionally pursue Him, and what will happen? We will find Him. It's a guarantee. God doesn't, I mean, when He makes a promise, He keeps His. I don't know what our record is, but I know He keeps His. So if we're neglecting, you know, it says that it's so great a salvation, but if we're neglecting this access that we have with God, to God, then shame on us. I mean, we may as well read the story and remove Saul and just put Drew in there. Because am I taking advantage, as I said, of what God has given me? So we looked at Saul, and you know, he is so consumed with wanting to be honored and loved and adored and served. I mean, what do we say about a king? What are they supposed to do? Serve. It says that, you know, even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and give His life a ransom for many. Saul was all interested in being served, right? You know, instead of honoring God and just being so appreciative and thankful, who did he set up a monument to after one of his victories?
Himself.
Himself. It's unbelievable. But I think there are times when we give ourselves credit or want to receive, at least in part, some of the credit that solely belongs to God, right? So, again, before we get too worked up in, you know, our judgment of Saul, I think that part of the reason God is so explicit and spends so much time in exposing his heart is so that we do not go down that road. During the same number, nearly the same number of chapters, we have this other individual who is said to have a heart after God's own heart. A man who will do all God's will, right? A man who is united to God as his heart beats with God, who enjoys his relationship with God, who delights in being in God's presence, who can't wait to be back in the tabernacle, right? And to spend time with God. So the contrast could not be greater. So I think God's laying that out in front of us. So as we came into chapter 18, we see that all is going well, seemingly. Certainly with David, and David being appreciated and David being honored. And the irony here, of course, is Saul is doing everything he can to basically demand or earn the respect and love and of the people. And David's seemingly, you know, uninterested in it, yet it's all falling his way, which is driving Saul crazy, right? So we looked at his own family, and that's how we open chapter 18. His own son, Jonathan, what did we say about him? Verse 1 and 3, in other places, we'll just stick with chapter 18 right now.
Loved him as a brother.
They have so much in common. They both have an authentic relationship with God. They both put their lives on the line for God. God spared both of them against incredible odds. And Jonathan sees in David something that he can identify with, share with, and very much desires to be in relationship with David as they together in a relationship with God, to the point where he makes a covenant with David, so much so he's willing to serve David. Jonathan is the heir to the throne, but he's interested in serving David, gives him his armor, and, you know, just, it's crazy. What's that?
Gives his robe to him.
Right.
Yeah,
it's very clear that he's...
I think he understands that God has chosen David.
I think this chapter is starting to let us know that people are becoming aware of what this anointing might be beyond serving Saul, beyond killing Goliath. And now, all of a sudden, you know, he's gaining momentum in the kingdom. It is apparent to Jonathan, although not to everyone, it becomes apparent to Saul, it even tells us directly, that the Spirit of God is upon him. I mean, in a very special way. The Spirit of God in chapter 16 came mightily upon David, and Jonathan is aware of it. And Saul confesses it, and yet instead of being drawn to him like Jonathan is, he is jealous and consumed with the desire to do away with it because he's a threat. It's an incredible, you know, turn of events. So we talked about Jonathan. We talked, I think, about his daughter, Michal. What do we find out about her? I know we've jumped ahead a little bit in the chapter to find it, but...
Well, she was promised to whoever could kill Goliath. And all the other accolades that went with that.
Well, it started with Merab, who was the oldest.
Oh, okay.
So let's just to be short about this, Michal loves David.
Yeah.
Yes.
She loves David. Wow. And then we find, and we made this argument last time, his own wife, Ahinoam, right? We put together, I think, an adequate circumstantial number of events and circumstances that show that there's somebody behind the scenes that is influencing her son and her daughter, and certainly aggravating her husband to no end, to the point where he finally calls her a what? Remember the language he uses with. He says, then Saul's anger burned against Jonathan, and he said to him, "You son of a perverse and rebellious woman." Excuse me. Where does that come from? That's verse 30 of chapter 20. Wow. So I think he understands that his whole family is taking sides, and it's not him. I don't understand why a mother or a wife wouldn't adore her husband who wanted to kill her son. What? Wanted to kill her son and has changed from being, you know, this victorious soldier who goes out and wins three battles, and now we find that he's afraid of Goliath, he won't lead the people, and, oh yeah, by the way, he's maniacal. A little hard to get along with when the evil spirit is upon him. So, yeah, there are reasons why the tide is turning against Saul.
Almost like Saul's going mad.
Oh, yeah. Well, he is mad under the influence, right? So we ended with the women who was certainly inclusive of who? The women came out and were singing and dancing and playing tambourines and musical instruments. Who would have been at the head of that parade? What woman would have been most proud of her husband? His previous victories. But then they start singing, Saul has slain his thousands and David his ten thousands. That didn't work for Saul. He didn't like that. And then finally, verse 8 and 9, which is where we're going with this. Then Saul became very angry. This saying displeased him, and he said, they have ascribed to David 10,000s, but to me they have ascribed thousands. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? So here we go. As y'all said just a minute ago, it's starting to become apparent that he has a rival instead of an heir, his son just taking the throne. He now has a rival to his throne. So it says that Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on. So we said that we were going to limit our information of what we knew about David and the circumstances to when they were given to us. So what can we authentically say that we know about David now? There's quite a few things, actually. We didn't know anything until they appeared, but what do we know about David?
The Spirit of the Lord was upon him.
Very good. That's absolutely true. Mightily. What else do we know?
Youngest of
the
seven boys.
Yeah, he's the eighth, but yeah. The youngest son of Jesse.
he was pleasing to all the other people as well.
It's incredible. I mean, you can look at, I think it's verse 16. Yeah, verse 16 of this chapter. But all Israel and Judah loved David as he went in and out, right? And it's going in and out. Oh, we'll get there in a minute. But what else do we know about him?
Well, he killed Goliath. I mean, he was...
Killed Goliath.
He wasn't even a warrior.
Okay, so what do we know about his age?
He was not even...
18 years old, yeah. Which meant he was disqualified from what?
Being...
Military service. So when it says he is not able, legally, yeah. who set that rule? Who set that law in motion? They just made it up? No, God did. So Saul was willing to do what with David?
He was willing to put him out there.
Sacrifice. Yeah. Well, what is sacrifice? What was he already willing to do with his own son?
Sacrifice.
I mean, this guy is, you know, I don't think he'd want to marry into this family. But yet it seemed like a good idea at the time. So what else do we know about him? He was bold, but he was very jealous for something, not of something. Saul is jealous of something. David's jealous for something.
For the presence of God. Yeah.
The presence of God. The reputation of God. Goliath is coming out mocking God.
Yeah, he calls him, you know, terrible things.
And David's not happy.
Infuriates David.
Sure. So what does he do first? What does David do? Are y'all listening to this guy? Somebody step up and go shut him up, right?
Yeah, he gets those stones.
And if you shut him up, what do you get? And he goes from one man to another to somebody else. He's going to find somebody to take this behemoth on. Finding nobody and being called in by Saul.
The troops were scared. Saul was scared. Yeah. Everybody was scared. David wasn't.
He was not. So he says, look, I'll take care of this thing. So at any rate, we see him really relying on God to the point of he puts his life in God's hands and for God's reputation. Does that remind you of anything? Putting your life in God's hands for the reputation of God.
Jesus.
Yeah. Well, certainly Jesus, but I mean, he came to die. But how about every martyr who is, you know, now what do martyrs have in common? They're all dead. Right? And they all died doing what? God's work, or declaring God, or defending God's honor, or making much of God. So anyway, let's go back to this non-coincidence. In chapter 18, verse 9, it says, "And Saul looked at David with suspicion from that day on, and he is going to set himself against David to the point of wanting to kill him." So many times in 1 Samuel that we have a hard time keeping up with it. But somebody would like to read 10 through 16.
It happened on the next day that a distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied inside the house. So David played music with his hand as at other times, but there was a spear in Saul's hand. And Saul cast the spear, for he said, "I will pin David to the wall." David escaped to the presence twice. Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul. Therefore Saul removed him from his presence and made him his captain over 1,000. And he went out and came in before the people. And David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore when Saul saw that he behaved very wisely, he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David as he went out and came in before them.
Wow. So, verse 10 is reasonably interesting given the fact that David has appeared before Saul on a number of occasions. And each time he came, he was sent for. Each time he was sent for, he would do what?
Play his harp.
Played his harp. In addition to that, he did what?
Worship
God. right? In worshiping God, who showed up?
God showed up.
And when God showed up, what did the evil spirit do?
Departed.
Didn't want any part of that, right? But isn't it interesting that Saul is under the influence of this evil spirit? It's happened a number of times, but on this occasion, what does Saul do? It's very peculiar. Instead of welcoming David to alleviate his problem, what does he do? He throws a spear at him. Well, it says twice. Twice, the second time is later. I mean, it's referring to this. 1 Samuel does a lot of this, forwards and backwards type of thing, but it's referring to, he does it twice. I mean, David's not being, he didn't throw a spear at him and says, you missed me, try again. No, he left, okay? But we find Saul trying to kill him again with a spear later. It'll be in chapter 19. What's going through Saul's mind?
I think he's trying to figure out how to get rid of David permanently.
Okay.
And he's totally consumed by this evil spirit.
Oh, so when he was more passive before and was willing to have David come in fact, desiring of David to come in to alleviate this condition, where do we find Saul in the progression of his stubbornness, his sin, and this influence of this evil spirit?
He'd rather live with the madness than have David around.
Unbelievable. Nailed it. He has reasoned in his mind, whatever capacity he has for that he'd rather be tormented. Because as far as he knows, David is his only cure. So he'd rather live maniacally, disturbed, afraid, and get rid of David. Huh.
That's his pride and arrogance coming out, is what you're saying earlier on.
All right, now we've taken the position of, I hope, when you go through this passage, we've encouraged each other to become each of the players, right? If you're David, you think as David did, you see the scene as David does. If you've become Saul, then you're trying to reason, why am I doing this thing? And I think Aaron nailed this, that like, this is what I'm thinking, this is what I'm feeling, this is why I'm reacting like this. What if you're an evil spirit? Have you been him yet? Have you been the evil spirit yet? Because you have a motive too. What is your motive? If this kid keeps playing and gets into worship, what's going to happen? God's going to show up. What's the last thing I want to happen?
Well, that evil spirit doesn't want that.
Okay. So he's exerting influence over Saul. Hey, just off him right here. Here's your chance. You got a spear. You're not very good with it because you're going to miss him twice and you're going to miss Jonathan too. You're really a lousy spear chucker.
Do it anyway.
You're no good at this. But think of the control that Saul yields to the spirit. And if you think we're talking about Saul right now, you're missing the point. If we yield our hearts and our motives and our desires to something other than God, there's going to be someone to pick up the slack. And in our stubbornness, we think we're making a decision. But I can tell you that as we watch Saul over the coming weeks, he becomes more maniacal. He does things that are so reprehensible, we hardly can believe it. Uh, I will pin David to the wall, I will kill him. But David escaped from his presence twice. So on this occasion, and then we'll see it again in chapter 19. Now Saul was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him, but had departed from Saul.
It does. We don't have to even guess here. We don't have to. We're not even putting two and two together.
God just tells us why Saul is afraid of David.
Because he's afraid of God, and God is with David.
God has left Saul.
Yeah.
Well, he doesn't want to lose his kingdom. Saul doesn't. That's one of the things that we're saying there. What's next?
So it's interesting that he is now kind of putting two and two together, that there's a rival to the throne. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we said that God gave Israel a king. What kind of king?
Someone like themselves.
Someone like themselves.
Yes.
So if you continue to reject God as your king, if you continue to embrace your will, as a nation, what are you going to do? You're going to reap the whirlwind, but what is your relationship with God going to be?
You're going to lose that relationship.
And you're going to be in trouble. Big trouble.
The big trouble.
Yeah.
He was afraid of David, for the Lord was with him. He's afraid of God, like you said. I mean, how pitiful is this? That you're afraid of God. You've been blessed by God, chosen by God, anointed by God, set up as the king over God's people, and you're afraid of God? This isn't like, hey, hello? You might want to check in with God,
yeah.
And if you have a trouble getting there on your own, God left you some breadcrumbs called Samuel, who would be a really good resource to ask, you know, what do I do next? How do I, you know, what's my next step here? So Saul's solution to this problem temporarily in verse 13 is to do what?
Take the commander of the army.
Out of sight. Out of my sentiment.
In hope that he gets killed, probably.
In the absolute hope that he's going to get killed.
Yeah. Makes me wonder how much time's gone by. Is he 20 yet?
That's a good question. That's a very good question. I think not. Yeah, by default, you killed Goliath, here's 1,000 men. All right, so he puts him out there. He's trying to get rid of him. And everywhere David goes, he's prospering because God is with him. Now, there's another biblical character that we've seen this happen with, right? God is with him. He seems to prosper with everything he does.
Joseph.
Yeah.
Now, prospering with, early on, he obeyed his father. He wasn't just compliant. He was obedient to his father. And for his efforts, he got what? Sold into slavery. He was a servant. He was a faithful servant to Potiphar. And God blessed him. And it was very apparent. So for his efforts, he got what?
Thrown
in jail. So now he's being faithful. Okay, so you get it, right? It didn't look like that things were going well for Joseph. And yet he remained faithful to the Lord. David remains faithful to the Lord. And there's this thing behind it, not just God's blessing, but there's an intent by Saul that is in complete contrast to this.
And true.
Yes.
Even though Joseph was faithful to the Lord, it's like when he was in jail, he kept saying, I think God forgot about me.
Yeah, he might have.
Yeah.
But he stayed faithful, right?
Yeah.
I think he was learning a lot in those last couple of years. All right, so he's prospering in all his ways. The Lord is with him. And so when Saul sees this, He can measure it. He can see it. It's measurable that he was prospering greatly. I mean, who's benefiting from David? Let's see. David plays the harp. Who benefits?
Saul.
David kills Goliath. Who benefits?
Saul.
He goes out and fights your battles for you. Who benefits?
Saul.
I know. Let's kill him. It's the logical thing to do. Kill the guy who's doing everything for you. Oh, there's a theme here, isn't there? Kill the guy who's doing everything for you. He dreaded him. But while he's dreading him, all of Israel and all of Judah love him. And he went out and came in before them. So what does that mean? He goes out with 1,000 men. He's going out. He comes back with 1,000 men. He's coming back. What's going on? What is this?
Apparently there's a celebration. Is there like a big parade and everybody's gathered?
He's winning. Why?
Yeah.
He's winning!
Yeah.
So each time that they go out, whose husbands, whose brothers, whose fathers are leaving? Everyone. So who shows up? Everyone to wish them well. And when they come back victorious, who shows up? They all do. We've been told how they show up. They're singing and dancing with tambourines and all this stuff. Who didn't go out?
Saul.
So when they come back, who are they praising?
David.
This is going well for Saul, isn't it? So this thing is going on. And Israel and Judah are falling in love with David, and he's such a great guy and all the rest of it. Somebody read 17 to 19 for us.
Saul said to David, "Here's my older daughter, Merib. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." For Saul said to himself, "I will not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that." But David said to Saul, "Who am I, and what is my family or my clan in Israel, that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merib, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Ariel of Mahola.
Wow. Saul's in a bit of a pickle, isn't he? Every time he tries to do something to David, it seems to work for David. He made a promise, and all of his men, all the warriors, everybody knows what the promise was. What was that? The man who kills Goliath, what's he in store for?
Marry his daughter.
Yeah, he'd become
riches.
Riches, and his family wouldn't have to pay taxes.
Uh-huh. They wouldn't have to serve in the army.
Yeah.
And his daughter. Okay, so let's examine this. We haven't gotten there yet, but when it comes time that David is going to marry one of his daughters, what does he not have? He has no money.
Yeah, he's
huh,
he's
no money.
He's just a shepherd.
Okay. Well, so something's missing there. And let's see. You don't serve in the army, so where is David? A commander of 1,000. So wait, let's see. Let's add this up. There were three. Oh, but now this is one he doesn't seem to be able to weasel out of. He says, okay, you can marry my daughter, Merib, his oldest daughter. David, on the other hand, says, well, wait a minute. What is his response to becoming part of Saul's family, to becoming royalty? What does he have to say about that?
He says, who am I?
Yeah,
who am I? That sounds like humility, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Is it? Indeed it is. Coming from David, it is. Let's back up the train a little bit. We said we go forwards and backwards. There was once a man who is told that he could be king, royalty. And he says, well, you don't understand. I'm from the smallest tribe, Benjamin. As a matter of fact, I'm not only from Benjamin, I'm from Gibeah, the center of the Sodom and Gomorrah-like behavior that brought on condemnation to Benjamin and nearly wiped out the entire tribe. Sounds like humility. Was it?
I think you wanted
Well, his humility didn't last. I mean, like, did he accept the nomination? Did he enjoy his coronation at Gilgal with all the feast and everything else? Did he, in fact, want to repeat that again later?
Yes.
Yes.
So, what would have been the appropriate response to Saul, you're going to be king?
We've already got a king.
Thank you. What did Gideon say after this great battle that they won? They wanted to make him king. And he said to the people, I will not be your king, nor will my son serve as your king, because God is your king.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That was the appropriate and correct answer. Saul goes, well, why me? But where's the crown?
What?
No, it didn't fit quite right. So his humility wasn't humble at all. As a matter of fact, he never humbles himself before God. So he's offered Merib as a wife. David double clutches and says, who am I and what is my life or my father's family in Israel that I should be the king's son-in-law? What would qualify me for this? He's not being king, just to be the king's son-in-law. And so while he's hesitating or whatever, and we'll find this out later, she's given to Adriel as a wife. Adriel, for whatever reason, would he have known that David was promised Merib? What's the backstory? We don't know what it is, but we can surmise. Was Merib asking her father and everybody else, hey, I want to marry David, I love David? No. So who might Adriel have been? Why would Saul renege on his promise to David and give his daughter to Adriel? You have to be Saul for a minute. If you're Saul, why did you do that?
He was an ally.
Adriel was what to you?
He was on your side.
So, Saul does nothing without getting something out of it. I mean, his every motive is for whom? His daughter's happiness?
Well, would this person have to pay a dowry or something?
Good question.
To marry his daughter?
Well, here's some choices. He's one of his commanders, right? He's one of his commanders. Or, he's a rich guy. Or he's well connected, or I don't know what it is. All I know is Saul has a motive for him to be his son-in-law, and it's not going to keep, he's willing to deny David what he said, and at this point has no intention of giving him any daughter. It's not until later that we find out that he is willing to do it again. So one of his reasons for saying it to begin with was he had to honor his promise to the troops and everything else because people were watching. But what is it in the hopes of? What does he say he wants David to do?
Marry Michael and socially ascertain.
That's the call. I'm talking about Mary. So just back up about two verses. What does it say?
Hopes the Philistines kill him.
Well, he does hope the Philistines kill him, but what does he ask David to do? I'm going to give you my daughter, just do us. What?
Serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord.
Okay, coming from the lips of Saul, are you believing this? He's invoking the name of God, which, his last comments were, the Lord your God, the Lord your God, the Lord your God. And now somehow or other,
by inference. Remember when Saul comes and he says, oh, I've obeyed the Lord, I've done the Lord's bidding, I've, you know, all this. Fight the Lord's battles. That's almost like, well, I won't say that. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole. It's just not sincere. It's not his real motive. It isn't, I mean, he wants him to die, but he colors it as if he wants him to go fight the Lord's battles. So he's hiding behind the name of God to accomplish his nefarious goal or his intent to off David. Again, is there any application here? Hiding behind some form of religion or some form of righteousness in order to achieve something else. There's a sad chapter coming up about Adriel. Adriel thinks he's getting a windfall here and marries Merib out from under David and clearly has no compulsion about it. If he had honored David, he would have told Saul, no, you've promised her to someone else. It will end up costing Adriel his life. What a good choice by Adriel. Now, somebody read 20 through 23 to start. 20 to 23.
Now Saul's daughter Michal loved David, and they told Saul that the thing pleased him. Saul thought, let me give her to him. She may be a snare for him, and that the hand of the Philistines may be against him. Therefore Saul said to David a second time, you shall now be my son-in-law. And Saul commanded his servants, speak to David in private and say, behold, the king has delighted you, and all his servants love you, now that you become the king's son-in-law. And Saul's servant spoke those words in the ears of David, and David said, does it seem to you a little thing to become the king's son-in-law, since I am a poor man and have no reputation?
Oh, he's a poor man. He should be a rich man. Saul hadn't rewarded him with anything. But let's go back to why or how does Michal become, and I'm saying Michal, I think some people pronounce it Michael, I can't do that, sorry. How does she become aware of David? How is her heart bent towards David? What's going on?
She was in love with him.
Okay, she says she, how does that happen?
Maybe was it from observing everything he did and his character and how the people loved him, and she loved him too.
Okay. What does it mean she loved him? Does she love him the way the Bible says that we should love someone?
Maybe she loved him for his notoriety rather than heartfelt.
She is the same one in 2 Samuel who will despise David when he dances before the Lord when they're moving the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem. She is embarrassed by his behavior. She looks down on him and she ridicules him and mocks him. Right? Does that sound like love to you?
No, I'm not.
Is it because she sees God in him? See, I think the number one reason Jonathan loves him is he sees the Lord in him and is drawn to that, and they are kindred spirits. Michal, it doesn't say anything about her loving him. As a matter of fact, as we read this, we're going to see her behave very much like Rachel. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but there, you know, she's in possession of a household idol. She's lying to her father. I mean, these things are repetitive. It looks a lot like Rachel.
So
what's in it for her then?
Huh?
What's in it for McCauley?
Huh? So why did she love it? What's going on?
Maybe he's just good looking and
he's just I like it. You're working with us.
That's the only way I can think of because he's a poor shepherd for it.
Okay, but he's good looking. He's what?
Popular.
What else is he? Successful. Everything he touches is successful, right? It'd be nice if she said she saw God in him. That's the reason she was attracted to him. But I think the evidence is going to prove otherwise. The one time he's really expressing it, she disdains him.
It shows you that she doesn't have a relationship with God.
Ah. But let's go back. We said, in the background, there's been somebody who's had an undue influence in this family. Somebody who she would confide in. Somebody who would encourage her in this direction. Somebody who obviously encouraged her son to know the Lord or to pursue the Lord, because it certainly didn't come from Saul. She has sung with the women about, you know, her own husband, but how David was even greater. So where's McCall getting some of this, do you suppose? I know this is circumstantial, but I think it's not us taking a great leap here. Ahinoam, who's that? Were you here last week?
Saul's wife.
Saul's wife. Their mother. Well, who does a girl confide in when it comes to matters of the heart? Who is she encouraged by or whatever? She doesn't go to her father. It's clear. She didn't come to him. She's informed. I wonder who's informing him. Later we'll find that Saul intends to kill David in his own home. And you'll find that McCall is going to lower David out of a window knowing that they're coming. I'm sorry. How did she know they were coming?
Her mother maybe told her.
Maybe her mother sent word. Who would have been one of the only people to know what Saul was up to by sending these men that night to arrest David, he intended to kill him. And somehow or other, the message gets to McCall first. I'm just saying, there's somebody behind the scenes that God's using to accomplish a lot of what's going on. And I don't think we're taking liberty with this. It's just circumstantial, but I think there's something to it.
She's part of the word they in verse 20. And they said to Saul...
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, who would he listen to? Because these are arranged marriages. And it's not her coming and saying, Daddy, give me him. Right? So it pleased Saul. Why? He's going, okay, we'll do this again. I'll give him McCall for what purpose? Before, he was going to make him... He's going to put him out there and fight the Lord's battles, which he does anyway. And he comes back victorious, which is aggravating the heck out of Saul. But this time, what will he do?
Will she be a snare for him?
A snare. So here's a father. Think about this. You know your daughter loves this man. Probably mom was, you know, involved in encouraging this as well. And you are so interested in your daughter's happiness and her well-being in the future that you want to kill the man that she loves. So you're going to use her to get to him. This is outrageous that he would use his own daughter to get, I mean, to step all over to get what he wants. We've never seen this before, Laban. We've never seen any father uses the Laban.
Well,
to,
yes.
To Laban.
Yeah.
Would sell his own daughters to Jacob for his own reasons. I mean, for wealth and for whatever else. Wow. Man, what an example of a father. intending, before they even get married, to kill him. Now, this is certainly going to bring nothing but heartache and hardship to his daughter, and he's okay with that. As long as he dies, he's okay with that. So he devises an idea. He says, okay, for a second time, you'd be my son-in-law. And he says, look, go convince him. He goes, go tell him how much I love him and how much I want him to be, you know, my son-in-law. Never mind that spear I tried to put through your gut the other day. I want you to be my son-in-law. But and David says, is it trivial in the sight? You know, like, well, you know, one minute you're trying to kill me, and now you want me to be your son-in-law. And so this one comes with an attached condition as well. Like he can't offer him anything like Adriel did, so he's going to have to perform a feat for Saul.
Makes me think that he wants him to be his son-in-law just to kill him. Yeah.
So, Joy, if you want to pick back up verse 24 to 29.
And the servants of Saul told him, thus and so did David speak. Then Saul said, thus shall you say to David, the king desires no bright price except 100 foreskins of the Philistines, that he may be avenged of the king's enemies. Now Saul thoughts made David fall by the hand of the Philistines. And when his servants told David the king's words, it pleased David well to be the king's son-in-law. Before the time had expired, David arose and went along with his men and killed 200 of the Philistines. And David brought their foreskins, which were given in full number to the king, that he might become the king's son-in-law. And Saul gave him his daughter Michal for a wife. But when Saul saw and knew the words of David, and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. So Saul was David's enemy continually.
Okay, thank you. So the servants come and they talk David into this. And this one comes with something that David can do, or David knows he can do. He couldn't be politically helpful to Saul. He couldn't offer him riches. But this is something that he feels like he can sort of do in service to the king and the country and kind of earn his place. And not that he hasn't already, but this makes sense to him that he can perform this military feat and you know, all will be well. So Saul wants him to kill 100 Philistines. And the proof of that will be so outrageous and so provocative that there won't be a Philistine on earth that doesn't know what's going on. I mean, it will enrage the ire or the fear or the resistance of every Philistine on earth if you know that the guy is running around killing people and taking their foreskins. I mean, this is, you can't be any more insulting. You know, I don't know. I mean, like, it's not even, it sounds worse than scalping. You know, just scalp. But what would be the motivation of a guy to stop this behavior? Pretty significant. So David, instead of going and killing 100 Philistines, goes and kills 200. Wow. God is definitely enabling him to do some outrageously bold and brave and militarily, you know, intelligent things. Saul's plan all along was to have David die from this. And instead, everything that Saul is doing is backfiring on him. Everything. Every time he tries to stop David, slow him down, try to get in the way, it just backfires on him. So Saul gave him Michal as his daughter as a wife. And what does it say in verse 29? How does that work? And now Saul's content because David is his son-in-law. He has him, you know, keep your friends close and your enemies closer, right? So Saul is even more afraid of David. He's once again seen God work through him to accomplish this thing. He knows what his motive was, and it totally backfired on him. So Saul has devoted himself to be David's enemy continually. What is another way of saying that?
He's going to continue to try to kill him. Get rid of him.
He will.
It's true. I also want to say him. If I knew David, I would take him inside and say, "Please be careful, you're going to get killed."
And David knows this, and he's going to, you know, talk to Jonathan about it soon. But as I said, everything is backfiring on him. It says that when he saw that the Lord was blessing everything that David was doing, when he knew that it wasn't just that he saw, but he knew that the Lord was with him, he decides that David will be what? His
enemy.
Another way of saying this is, who is Saul's enemy?
God.
Let me take you to the last chapter, or second, let's see, it's chapter 22, I think. Saul conjures up the spirit of Samuel. And Samuel is having a conversation with Saul, and Saul is looking for information. He says in verse 15, "And God has departed from me and answers me no more, either through prophets or by dreams. Therefore I have called you that you may make known to me what I should do." And Samuel says this, "Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has departed from you and has become your adversary, your enemy?"
What chapter is that?
That's chapter 28, verse 15 and 16. Saul makes God his enemy, and God reciprocates. He says, "If you love me, if you seek me, if you honor me, I will open the windows of heaven and bless you," right? "But if you reject me, I will reject you." If I am your enemy, if you're making me out to be your enemy, if you disregard everything I ever ask you to do and you dishonor me and everything else, then what will you become of mine? This is frightening.
Yeah.
It's frightening that God could be your enemy. I mean, how this does not humble Saul is beyond me. I mean, it's just like I said, it keeps going to a darker and darker place. And then finally, verse 30, "Then the commanders of the Philistines went out to battle, and it happened as often as they went out that David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so his name was highly esteemed." If you wanted to do anything to make Saul crazier, you couldn't accomplish it better. Everything he does backfires. He wants the love of the people, he wants their adoration, he wants to be honored, and everything he does directs their honor and their praise and their adoration to David. Every time he wants to kill David, David is victorious. Every time he plots something with his daughter, David is victorious. Everything that he tries to do, you would think somewhere along the way that Saul would understand that God is behind him.
Yeah, but I mean, Samuel even told him that, you know, the kingdom is going to be taken from you and it will be given to another.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so I wonder if Saul's even thinking about that.
Well, Wayne said earlier, what was he afraid of? What was Saul jealous of?
His kingdom.
His kingdom. This is the same guy who said, "Oh, I'm not worthy.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Who am I?" And then the minute he has it, it's his, it's mine, and you can't have it.
He's putting himself in God's hands. place. I mean, he's the earthly king, and God is the king.
Yeah.
And he doesn't acknowledge that.
Well, again, I want us to appreciate the fact that Saul's life, as sad as it is and as pitiful as it is at times, serves as an illustration to us. I mean, the story, although in real time is about Saul, is today written to us. So if we are at odds with God, if we are trying to manipulate circumstances in our life to suit ourselves, if we are not submissive or surrender to God, if we don't really care about what God's direction for our life is, if we are fighting God tooth and nail instead of surrendering and submitting and embracing what God has for us, wow, it could serve to be very difficult going forward. God has said, you can go through all sorts of difficult circumstances with me because I will be with you. But if I'm not with you, it serves a dire situation. Somebody want to pray for us as we close?
Sure. Thanks. Father, thank you. Thank you for your word. Thank you for opening your word and your spirit and your character to us through Drew and for the time that he spends looking into every little detail here. We pray that you would give each of us that same grace, that same ability, that same desire to learn of your spirit, learn of your character, and then to put that to good use as we are imitators of Christ. And we pray that you would bless the week and pray for the service this morning. And we ask for blessing in Jesus' name.
Amen. Thank you.